It's a great pleasure to be talking today to Philippe Sands, whose books I love, as will so many who are listening to this. I haven't, I confess, read the legal text, but the four historical works I first came across him, I think, in the FT, or was it on television? He is absolutely everywhere, this man. And what was it that led you, when you were doing a perfectly honest, decent thing in the lawyer's profession, to want to write the book that in 2016, coming up to the 10th anniversary, won the prestigious, very prestigious Bailey Gifford Prize, and is translated into 24 different countries with different languages, East West Street, on the origins of genocide and crimes against humanity. Why did you not just get on with your day job?
I love my day job, Anthony. It's incredibly nice to be with you, and I could spend a full hour talking to you about the wonders of teaching law students at UCL or appearing in various courts, and your listeners would be bored out of their minds.
I'm just going to say, thanks for the invitation.
Actually, to be honest, the change, the big change was 2016 with the publication of East West Street, but you have to go back a little bit beyond to 2003 and the war in Iraq. And in October of that year, after the war started, I went to a dinner party. A good friend of ours, actually the person who had introduced me to my wife, Julia Hobsbawm. And at the dinner party, I sat next to a very nice lady who was a publisher for Penguin. And telling people that you're an international lawyer is often the kiss of death at a dinner party.
It's almost as bad as saying you're a school teacher.
No, school teacher's great. What's terrible? I think international law is just below investment banker in the scheme of horrors. School teachers always great.
Mostly for listening to this, are going to be investment bankers.
Yeah, I know, but you have interesting stories. Anyway, let's go back to the dinner party. I'm sitting next to a very nice lady called Margaret Blumen. And she says, what do you do? Blah, blah, blah. And cut to the chase, I tell her about, you know, nuclear testing and wars and boundary disputes. And she says, oh, that all sounds very interesting. And of course, Iraq. Are you able to write a book that makes these things comprehensible to ordinary, intelligent people in the grand public? And I said, well, I'll try. So I wrote a proposal. She said, yes, you can write, and gave me a contract for what became the book Lawless World. One thing led to the next. And two books later, Stuart Prophet, who had become my publisher at Penguin, said, what are you going to do next? I gave him five options. Four of them were my kind of boring legal stuff that I love doing. And one of them was the story of this mad town in Ukraine called Lviv, my grandfather and the founders of Crimes Against Humanity and Genocide. And he said, that's what you must write.
He is an extraordinary editor, publisher, Stuart Prophet. And so we'll come on to that. But let's just look at the call to account about the Iraq War in 2007. Which is one of several plays, television scripts, films that your work has informed. Tell us about that. What is that story?
Story is the sort of hypothetical trial of Mr. Anthony Blair for the crime of aggression. And it was based on one chapter in the book Lawless World, which revealed, and you probably remember this because you have an excellent memory, that that book made public the secret legal advice given by Peter Goldsmith to the Prime Minister shortly before the war, which directly contradicted the public advice. In other words, Peter Goldsmith said, basically, you need a Security Council resolution to make this lawful. And the book revealed that that opinion was squashed, that a new opinion was prepared, which gave the contrary view. And the play Called to Account and the TV series, which was made on the basis of a play at the Tricycle Theatre, takes that story. What really happened
in the 10 days between advice number one, which said you can't go to war, and advice number two, which said you can.
And tell us, remind us of that story, Philippe.
Well, I have to be very careful how I talk about that story because I don't want to get myself into trouble. But by means that have not yet been fully explained, Lord Goldsmith was encouraged to change his mind. He was assisted in that act of encouragement by numerous lawyers, including some colleagues of mine who found new arguments for him, despite the fact that nothing factual or legal had changed in the intervening 10 days. So others have reached their view as to the impact of certain pressures that may have been put on the Attorney General. I don't express a view on that. The simple reality is that in unexplained circumstances, he did a 180-degree turn and basically allowed Tony Blair to go to war on a false premise, and a premise that all international lawyers think is illegal, and which one of them, Elizabeth Wilmshurst, who resigned from the Foreign Office, characterized as a crime of aggression. And people remain fascinated in that story today.
He doesn't see it that way, and he's a lawyer. What was in his mind?
Big question. I of course, I'm not able to get into his mind, but I suspect it is something that is very resonant today, which is to stay as close as possible to the United States. And he probably, I don't know this for a fact, formed the view that the United States was going to go ahead with or without Britain. And in those circumstances, I think he wanted Britain to be there. One of the things that I have discovered in the last weeks and months in writing my latest book, 38 Londres Street, and spoken to people who were in 10 Downing Street at that period, because the Pinochet story coincided temporally with the Iraq story, is that those closest to him have all formed the view that Iraq was a terrible mistake, and they wish that he too would recognize that.
We've spoken about it. He doesn't recognize it. How much harm do you think it did in Iraq and in the region? And how much harm did it do to the reputation of international law, and how much harm did it do to him?
Fabulous questions, complex questions. I mean, the harm to Iraq, I think, was momentous. I mean, just in terms of the number of lives that were lost, I don't know the exact numbers, but it's tens and tens and tens of thousands, if not more. So I think we've seen Iraq that has been in a degree of turmoil ever since, and which has in effect handed Iraq over to proxies in Iran, which I think a lot of people worried about, including the ambassador, Britain's recent former ambassador at the time, Harold Walker, who predicted exactly what would happen. I think it has done very significant damage to countries like the United Kingdom and the United States' ability to invoke international law. I mean, essentially, Vladimir Putin ran with a variation of the theme of the argument made by Britain and the United States, weapons of mass destruction, in justifying the war in Ukraine. That was extremely worrisome. So you can see the runoff consequence of making that argument. And I think in relation to Tony Blair, my view generally is he did many extraordinary and positive things for the United Kingdom. I mean, I had young children at the time, the money that went into schools, the money that went into the health service, the sense of buoyancy in terms of British identity and the country and the feel-good factor. I think he did extraordinary things. And I deeply regret that so much of that is overshadowed by that single decision. He can't go out on the streets. And that tells you something about the consequences for his legacy. Deeply regrettable, because I think with the benefit of hindsight, and even at the time, there were many things, his three terms as Prime Minister were very notable and very positive for.
all premierships are defined by one defining event, and for him that was Iraq. And but moving on from that story to torture team, 2010, this is in the long build-up to East West Street. What was that about?
One of the things, and you know this as a teacher, that one of the things that I've always tried to do is stick close to what I know about. And what I know about is how the law works and how decisions are taken and how they ought to be taken and how the legal mind works. And I'm fascinated by the legal mind and the social function of the lawyer. So I came across materials. I mean, one of the things that I seem to be quite good at is getting people to give me documents that they shouldn't give me. And I've never revealed who gave me the legal advice on Iraq, and I never will. But the same thing happened with the legal advices in relation to techniques of interrogation, enhanced interrogation, as the administration of President Bush put it, which included such matters as waterboarding, which most reasonable people think of as a means of torture. And so I became very interested in how could it be that a country like the United States, which is so committed to the rule of law and which has a military which is deeply committed to the rules. I know many of the military lawyers in the US Department of Defense and the JAG lawyers. They're superb. This was not done by them. They circumvented the rules, the administration did, by bringing in private lawyers who knew nothing about the substance. And of course, that opened the door to techniques of interrogation that got the United States into terrible difficulty, from which, in a sense, it has never really recovered. And a lot of what's going on today in the United States, I think, is a continuation of what was decided in those periods. For me, there is a direct line connecting Iraq, the torture at Bagram and at Guantanamo and other places, and what's happening in the US today. Once you cross a line, there's no going back. And one thing always leaves.
And before Guantanamo and after 9/11, had the US ever used torture as an agent of state power?
Not in that way. I mean, there are arguments, but I'm not on top of the evidence, that the US assisted others, for example, in Chile, in designing techniques of interrogation. What I do know, I mean, I've just spent a lot of time with US military lawyers, JAG officers, as they're called. These are remarkable people, and they were as horrified as anybody by what happened. That it would not be on their watch that such things would happen. It is only when the military folks are circumvented by the political appointees that these kinds of things come to pass. And my sense of the US military is that they're really pretty impeccable on their legal obligations. So they would not have been involved in this kind of stuff. There may have been political training in other countries of various techniques. Chile is one place it's often talked about.
Let's come through then to East West Street. And I can't imagine that there's many people who haven't read it, but can you recount the story, Philippe, about how you mentioned your excellent editor at Penguin, how you came across the story and what you were trying to say in this hugely significant book?
Well, it was an accident. I wish I could claim credit to having a hunch or a thesis or in some way pursuing an idea that was at the back of my mind. It was totally an accident. We're April 2010. I receive an invitation to give a lecture on the cases that I do on crimes against humanity and genocide before international courts, Rwanda, Yugoslavia, my day job, as you put it before. And the invitation comes from the law faculty of the University of Lviv, which very frankly, I'd never heard of. So I do what most people would do. I Google it and I see very quickly that Lviv was Lwów in Poland, and before that, Lemberg, when it's part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. and a light goes off in my brain. Lemberg, that's where my granddad was born. That's interesting. I want to go there. Not to give a lecture, to be honest, but to go and find the house where he was born. I thought that would be interesting. So that causes me to ask my mum, what has she got in terms of papers from that period? And it turned out she had quite a lot. I was in my 50th year and I didn't know anything about this. And so she she comes into her living room with two plastic bags heaving with documents from the Austro-Hungarian Empire days. And I go through them and I find the addresses where he was born and so on and so forth. And in the meantime, I do have to give a lecture and I do tend to prepare for lectures. So I think, okay, what am I going to talk about? And I get into the origins of genocide and crimes against humanity and stumble across two facts. One, the man who invented the word genocide, Raphael Lemkin, studied at the University of Lviv. How amazing, I thought. And then I discover that the man who put the concept of crimes against humanity into international law in the Nuremberg Statute in 1945, he also studied at the same university who'd invited me. But when I get to the university, they'd never heard of these two characters. So I sort of arrived bringing this fantastic tales of the greatness of the University of Lviv in historical terms. But it was also a very personal story because Hirsch Lauterpacht, who put crimes against humanity into the Nuremberg Statute and who worked on Nuremberg with Robert Jackson, the U.S. Justice of the Supreme Court, who was the chief prosecutor, was the father of my first teacher of international law and my mentor, Elie Lauterpacht, fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge, who got me my first job as a 23-year-old in 1984. So it became a very personal story. I started writing it about three men, Leon, my grandfather, Lauterpacht, Crimes Against Humanity, Lemkin, Genocide. And then onto the story came a fourth man, Hans Frank, who was Adolf Hitler's personal lawyer from 1928 to 1933. And I got interested in him because it turned out that he was hanged at Nuremberg for the murder of 4 million people. It's a rather large number. And it included the families of Lauterpacht, Lemkin, and my grandfather. So he became the point of commonality. And he became the fourth character in the book.
How did you make sense of this trans-European, trans-history, extraordinary, powerful? How do you bring all that together into a coherent narrative?
Very slowly, Anthony, is the answer to your question. I had the great fortune. I've had many great fortunes. One is that I had a fantastic editor. The book, in the end, did not find a publisher in the UK originally, so my agents hived me off to America, and I was directed to a lady called Victoria Wilson at Alfred Knopf Publishers. And she said, yes, I'll buy this book, but I will buy it under two conditions. One, I will be the only editor. There will be no English editor, no one else involved. And two, you will completely rewrite it. By the time she said those words, I thought I had a complete and excellent first draft. There would be four more drafts over 5 years. And she, I mean, to give you a very, to give the listeners a simple example of how a good editor works, the way I'd written the book, it's basically the period between 1914 and 1945. And so I'd start with all four men in 1914 and then tell their stories in a sort of intermingled way. And Vicky Wilson said, no, that won't work. People are very intelligent, but they need help. And they'll get very confused between four men who, to all intents and purposes, look very similar and are all of a similar type. So do it like this. Part one, your grandfather, up until the moment the Nuremberg trial starts. Part two, Lauterpacht, until the same moment. Part three, Lemkin, until the same moment. Part four, Frank, until the same moment. And then, by the time you commingle during the Nuremberg trial, everyone has worked out who is who. That is brilliant editing. And the book has had legs, I think, in large part because of a brilliant editor.
Can you talk about how the origin of, I mean, genocide is as old as history, the origin of the term, and just a bit about the origin of crimes against humanity, that concept, how they came into popular existence through those two people?
Sure. It's a very significant question. To be honest, I did not realize as I was writing the book the significance of the relationship between crimes against humanity and genocide, or how it would be picked up around the world. Essentially, these two characters, Lauterpacht and Lemkin, had a different conception of how law might protect us. Lauterpacht's view was that every individual, as an individual, irrespective of who or where they are, had minimum rights under international law, and they should be protected in that way as individual sentient human beings. Lemkin had a different view. He said, no, that's not how it works. People get targeted not because of their individual characteristics or even what they've done. They get targeted because they happen to be a member of a group that is hated at a particular moment in time or place. So if you want to protect human beings, protect them by protecting the group of which they are a member and make the group the object of the protection. Lauterpacht objected to that. Lauterpacht said, by taking this approach, you will replace the tyranny of the state with the tyranny of the group, which I think has rather happened, actually. I think in intellectual terms, I'm really with Lauterpacht and the protection of individuals and crimes against humanity. But I understand Lemkin's thesis, and I can see why he did what he did. But I fear that the invention of the concept of genocide has reinforced group identities and may even have given rise to the very things that he wished to save us from. In other words, by creating a sort of psychological sense of connection with our group and groups we hate, we reinforce the psychological element and we reinforce intergroup hatred. And that was Lauterpacht's concern. But in writing the book, I stumbled across these ideas without realizing their significance. And of course, they've become ever more resonant in the last 10 years, or at least more apparently resonant.
Absolutely. And this extraordinary city of Lviv, which kept changing country, as you said, and East-West Street? Explain that. What's East-West Street?
Have you been to Lviv, Anthony?
You know, I'm going to be walking through Lviv on the way to the Ukraine front line for my next walking book. I have not been there yet.
Can you make sure you alert me beforehand? Because I'm going to put you in touch with a couple of the most remarkable people I've ever come across, who are dear friends, and they'll give you a little tour of special places. So remind me to do that. It is an incredible city. I mean, one of the themes that I have in my head is when Lauterpacht was a student in November 1918, in a course taken by a very famous Polish professor, Julius Makarewicz, professor of criminal law. Over the course of 4 weeks in a single month, in November 1918, the control of the city changes hands four times. It goes from being Austrian, Polish, Western Ukrainian, then Polish again. And I've often wondered what on earth, you know, we're both teachers, what on earth did Makarewicz teach in each week? Did you change your course materials in week two and week three to accord with the legal systems of the new entity that was temporarily in control? It's utterly fascinating. East-West Street actually refers to a street in a small, very small town, population about 10,000, which is about 25 kilometers, 15 miles to the north of Lviv, called Zhilkiev. This was the town in where Hirsch Lauterpacht was born. And he was born on Lembergerstrasse, Lemberg Street. And then doing the research about my grandfather, I discovered that his mum, my great-grandmother, was also born on Lembergerstrasse in Zhilkiev. And so they were born on the same street. I remember when Elie Lauterpacht I'd known since 1983. And he had been my teacher, and then we were colleagues, and then he was my mentor, and then we became friends. We did cases together and other things. And in 2014, when I discovered this fact, I'd known him for 31 years. And I said to him, Ellie, can you imagine that we can trace our roots to the very same street in this, you know, miles away place that we'd never heard of? And he was chuffed by that. The street, Lemberger Straße, was the kind called by the great writer Joseph Roth, East-West Street, because he wrote a series of books in which he would describe these small towns as always being built on an axis. There'd be two main streets, East-West Street and North-South Street. And it was Vicki Wilson, again, the great Vicki Wilson, who said, that's your title. And it was brilliant. It was brilliant.
And let's introduce Hans Frank there. Why this man who was so bright and such a good musician, so cultured, refined in many ways, turned out to be arguably the biggest mass murderer in history?
I often ask myself that question, because he was truly a cultured individual. As his son Nicholas, who I've come to know very well and I'm very close to, said, he could recite pages and pages of Shakespeare, of Goethe, of Heine. He was a world-class chess player. And when I ask Nick how he explains his father's behavior, he says a lack of civil courage. He was a weak man who was ambitious and decided to cross a line early on, and one thing led to another. But I've got a lovely little anecdote to share with you, which is very timely. No one knows about yet, and you're the first. In 1936, the University of Modena in Italy gave Hans Frank an honorary doctorate for his contribution to the rule of law. Mm. And after the war, and in particular after he'd been convicted and hanged at Nuremberg, they were a little embarrassed about this fact, and they took some steps to try to rescind the honorary doctorate. But an honorary doctorate from the University of Modena is like a Nobel Prize. Once you've awarded it, it cannot be taken away. Under the law of Italy and under the regulations of the University of Modena. So the matter died. Then East-West Street is published, including in Italian. And there's a bit of mayhem in Modena when the members of the law faculty in Modena suddenly think, oh my God, our law faculty has honored the central character in Sands's book. What can we do about it? Turned out they could do nothing about it because Italian law had not changed and the regulations in the University of Modena had not changed. 1 month ago, I get an email from the dean of the law faculty to say, hallelujah, Italian law has changed. The regulations have changed. On the 31st of October, 2025, there will be a ceremony, big ceremony in the University of Modena to withdraw the honorary doctorate given to Hans Frank. Would you like to come and be the keynote speaker? I said, I'd be thrilled to go, but I have one condition. I must be accompanied by Nicholas Frank. The dean said, well, do you think he'll come? And I said, oh yes, he'll come. I called Nicholas and said, exactly as I've just said to you. And he said, Philippe, it will be the greatest day of my life. I will be there with you on Friday, the 31st of October, which is, you know, in a month's time or so. So we're toddling off to Modena, and there'll be some great, fancy, wonderful Italian ceremony to formally withdraw the honorary doctorate of Hans Frank, hanged at Nuremberg for murdering 4 million human beings.
An incredible story. And just give everyone a sense, this was a sense about what is that like for Nicholas to have a, you know, almost everybody perhaps wants to look up to their parents, but to have your father, who is known as the biggest murderer in history, how do psychologically you distance yourself? How has he processed that? And can you just say a word about the Wawel Castle, however you pronounce it, in Krakow, which was his main base during his murder spree?
Well, Nicholas is a remarkable person. highly intelligent. He was a very famous journalist for Stern magazine in Germany, so a distinguished person in his own right. In fact, he tells an absolutely remarkable story when that fellow from Solidarity became Prime Minister of Poland.
Lech Wałęsa becomes Prime Minister.
Stern sends Nicholas Frank to interview him in the Belvedere Castle in Warsaw. And the moment Nicholas walks into the room with Wałęsa sitting at a round table, Nicky Frank recognizes the table and remembers the time in 1943 when his father chased him around the table in the same room. That's the kind of remarkable history Nicholas Frank has. He has real trouble dealing with what his father did. I must say, I find it hard to imagine how I would deal with a parent who is hanged for the murder of 4 million human beings. The first time I met Nicholas, once I decided I wanted to write about Hans Frank, I mean, I prepare for writing these books as though I'm preparing a case. I leave no stone unturned. I'll have one or two research assistants. Everything that's ever been written on Hans Frank, I find a book called Der Vater, The Father, written by one Nicholas Frank, his son, and track him down. And we meet in a hotel in Hamburg, in Blankenese. And the first thing he says to me is, Philippe, you have to understand, I'm against the death penalty in every case, except the case of my father. And the second thing he does is he puts his hand into his jacket pocket and pulls out an old black and white photograph. I'm rather shocked by it because it is the hanged body of his father. And he says to me, I keep this on my person so I can at all times assure myself that my father is well and truly dead. That I think is the simplest way of explaining the trauma that Nicholas has been through and the impact on his being in terms of coming to terms with this issue. He's made it just a campaign. And right now, it has to be said, he's extremely worried about what's happening in Germany. As someone, you know, who met Hitler, who was close to the whole thing, who is well-read, he says, and I don't know whether he's right, what the Germans did back then, they are well capable of doing again, and we must be seriously worried by the turn my country is taking. It's rather distressing hearing him talk about modern Germany.
Thinking in particular of the AfD, and of course Hans Frank, part of his jurisdiction included the town of Auschwitz, where 1.2 million perished. Let's move on.
Just before we do, I remember I didn't answer your question about the Wawel, and there is one good image that your viewers may want to have in their minds. Nicholas grew up in the Wawel Castle in the center of Krakow, an imposing fortress atop a hill overlooking the whole of Krakow. It was headquarters for Hans Frank. And Hans Frank, being a cultured man, wanted some decent art around. And so he basically nabbed things from local museums and private collections, including the portrait of Cecilia Gallerani, the lady with an ermine by Leonardo da Vinci, which hung in the private rooms of the Wawel Castle. And Nick Frank told me that his father would make him stand in front of the painting and admire the woman. And Nick, as a little boy, 4 or 5 years old, was frightened by the painting because he thought the ermine was a rat and he didn't like the creature that was being held. 70 years later, in 2014, Nicholas and I traveled together to Krakow to visit the Wawel Castle. He wanted to show me the rooms in which he had grown up. And we were astonished to discover that the portrait of Cecilia Gallerani by Leonardo da Vinci is once again hanging in the Wawel Castle. So we asked for permission to be able to visit it together out of hours, for which you'll be interested to know the owners decided to charge us a very hefty fee. And we stood before that painting, and I can honestly say that in the writing of East West Street, one of the most powerful moments I experienced amongst many was standing before Leonardo's painting with Nicholas Frank and having him reminisce about the last time he had seen the painting in 1944, holding his father's hand. It was very, very striking.
Very hard to think of a more extreme case of child-parent alienation and separation and seduction by abuse by the parent, and how the child has managed to find their own identity and their own purposeful life. It's a profoundly moving book. I'm sure everyone who hasn't read it will have want to read it who's now listening. Let's move on to the rat line. Love, Lies, and Justice on the Trail of a Nazi Fugitive, that was published 4 years after East West Street in 2020. Can you take us through that story, Otto Vector? What happened there? And how did you write that?
Well, equally accidental, Anthony. So at a certain point, I have Nicholas to blame for this. Nicholas says to me, Philippe, you're interested in Lviv. Would you like to meet the son of the governor of Lviv? And I said, yes, I would, actually. I don't know why he'd want to meet me, but very happy to meet him. So he said, well, let me get in touch with his son, Horst Vector. And Nicholas got in touch with Horst. Horst would be delighted to accommodate us, to visit at his Schloss, his tiny village in Hagenberg, northern Austria, completely run down. Horst is totally impecunious. And we toddled off there. And at a certain point, Horst said, would you like to see my library in the attic? And I can take you to the Nazi section. And so we said, oh, yes, I would like to see that. So we went up to the attic. And in the attic, there was this just, it was all of his father's books. It was incredible. His father and mother Charlotte's books. And I remember at one moment, I just lent him, picked out a black volume and opened it and noticed it was a gift, a birthday gift from Heinrich Himmler to Otto Vector, signed with an incredibly warm inscription. It's that kind of sort of bonkers scene that you can imagine. Anyway, one thing led to another. I got interested in this character, Horst, who's very different from Nicholas. Nicholas hates his father. Horst loves his father. And I was interested in that. And one day Horst said, look, Philippe, my parents were big letter writers and postcards and photographs. And would you like to see their archive? 10,000 pages of extraordinary material from 1929, the day they met, until 1949, the day he died. And I said, well, yes, actually, I would like to see that. So I went back to Hagenberg and I spent days with this material. And it is literally unbelievable. It's I think it's the most complete archive of top table Nazis that has ever, a private archive that's ever been uncovered. I suggested to Horst, who is an interesting character, that this really ought to be in a museum. He said, wonderful idea, Philippe, wonderful idea. What museum? And I said, well, the museum that would digitize it best is the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. I knew the archivist there. And he said, well, that's a marvelous idea. Would you introduce me? So I did. And then the Holocaust Museum sent four people over. They digitized the 10,000 pages. And they are now all available. All you need to do is go on the website of the Holocaust Museum, type in Vechter Archive, W-A-U-M-L-A-U-T-E-R Archive, and you will get the most extraordinary bundle of documents you could imagine. Of course, this has led to absolute fury from Horst's family, who are not all as open as he is about these matters. And he's
Tell us about this dreadful man, Otto.
Oh, he really is. He really is bad news. I mean, he really was a true believer. Well, actually, Charlotta, his wife, was as bad. He was Hans Frank's number two. He was the governor of District Galicia, based in Lviv, for nearly 4 years. He was before that in Krakow. He's the man who created the famous Krakow ghetto with the walls designed by his wife. You'll be
as tombstones.
I mean, incredible. The wife said, I don't know what they've got to complain about. We've made the most beautiful wall for them. It's so elegant and it's Arabic sort of sentiments. How can I best describe Otto Wächter? Again, I think simple stories are the best way. One day in about 1942 or 43, Otto's father, Josef, General Josef von Wächter, writes to his son, the governor of Lviv, and says, look, son, been a bit of a cock-up. I've got a friend, he's married a Jew, they've had a child, and that child is now, you know, in detention and being mistreated in Krakow. Do you think you could intervene and get her out to stop her being abused? She's a lovely young girl. And so we got the correspondence of Otto, in the family archive, of Wächter's reaction, which is, of course, Papa, I'll look into this. He does look into it. He ascertains that it is indeed the case that this young girl has been detained and is being awfully abused. But he writes back to his father and says, look, I am able to do something, but I don't want to do anything because we have these race laws for a particular reason. They are to protect us from these kinds of people. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to do anything. And that sort of illustrated to me the inhumanity of the man. I mean, even in relation to his own father, he was a true believer. And Horst maintains the notion that his dad was a good man who did not knowingly or willingly lock people up, ghettoize them, exterminate them. But I'm afraid the facts tell a very different story. And so Horst and I are locked in a long-standing dispute over whether his father was a good man or a not-so-good man.
And the conclusion of the book, talk us about the fugitive aspect.
Well, that is very interesting. So what I became fascinated about was in the archive, I found all the letters and documents that were available, at least, to the extent they hadn't been filleted out, of Wächter on the run after the war. And this is fascinating because this gives us insights into the place he headed to, which was Rome, and some support from within the Vatican. I choose my words very carefully here. I don't say Vatican support. I think there were individuals within the Vatican, in particular an Austrian bishop called Alois Hudal, who ran a place called the Anima Institute, who helped a lot of Nazis escape to South America. Interestingly, in relation to another book that we may come to that I wrote later called The Last Colony on Chagos, I've just attended a private audience with Pope Leo XIV, and I was asked to bring some books along, and I wondered whether I should include in the little pile of books I would give him the Ratline, but I decided, just having read myself in, that he was quite an open-minded fellow, Leo XIV, and so I did give it to him, and he thanked me for all of the books. Incidentally, when I met him, I did also thank him. It is worth mentioning, through him, the community in just to the south of Paris, in a town called Meudon, who in 1942, 1943, 1944, hid my mother, a Jewish child in Nazi-occupied France, and saved her life. And I wanted to be sure to thank Pope Leo for that community's role in saving my mother's life as an infant. So these stories are very complex. I mean, one of the things you'll have picked up across the board of my writings is I don't impose on the reader, who is usually very intelligent, my views on matters. My job, I feel, is to lay out the material, and people can then form their own views as to the merits and demerits of various things or people or whatever. And so in relation to the role of the Vatican, I'm very, very careful, but the fugitive aspect does lead straight to Rome and from Rome to South America.
And obviously huge question marks as you say, about the role of the papacy, and that debate goes on and on. And he's eventually being tracked down. Otto Wächter, what happened there?
Well, he dies. He dies in...
How does he escape? How does he escape the fate of Mengele? Why did the Jewish hunters and others not get him?
He died too early for them to get him. He died in July 1949 in the Santo Spirito Hospital. Incidentally, if any of your listeners are ever in Rome, run, don't walk, to the Santo Spirito and the Sala Baglivi where he died. It's one of the most extraordinary rooms I've ever been in. He escaped. He was hidden for several months in the Austrian mountains. I went to see the hiding places, actually, now that I had the details from his correspondence. I was able to go and visit them. And I was able to do something else. For any of your listeners who are hikers, there is a remarkable crossing the Dolomites walk from Innsbruck to Bolzano, which we did with my then 15-year-old daughter, following in the trail of Otto Wächter. And it was indeed one of the most extraordinary walks I've ever done. You rise from 1,200 meters to 3,000 meters in the space of a day. It was pretty tough. It was June. There's still quite a lot of snow around. Wächter did the same walk in February when it would have been iced up. How someone escapes by that route is almost beyond comprehension. It's so dangerous. But for walkers, I can strongly recommend a summer hike across the Dolomites. It's really extraordinary.
Wonderful prospect. And evil. Does evil inhabit people? Are some people naturally prone to evil? And how come there was such an accumulation of evil people at this moment in history in one particular country?
I'm not sure there was such an accumulation. I mean, I ask myself this question very often. I also ask myself the question, what might I do in certain circumstances? I mean, my instinct is that all of us are, in theory, capable of doing terrible things. I hope that I wouldn't do such things, but do I really know in extremis what I would do? I'm very careful in writing these books. For example, I never refer to Frank or Wächter as monsters, because I don't think they were monstrous. I think there are people who did monstrous things. What's so troubling is they are also capable of love and decency and generosity and cultured, intelligent things. And that is the reality of life. I think you and I, Anthony, could sit down over dinner with Hans Frank and probably have a pretty decent evening. And that's what worries me. You know, how is it that someone with this background could have done what he did? So I think it's about conditions and times and a sort of lemming-like capacity of humans to follow. I fear to a certain extent we're heading into that period right now, actually, where we're seeing people follow into directions. I mean, one sees it right now in the United States. I think the main operating principle for a governor, a government, a leader to bring people to heel is to create a climate of fear. It's the one thing that I've seen in all of my work, whether it's the legal work or whether it's the writing the books, is that people are more likely to do terrible things if they live in a climate of fear. I think we're sort of seeing that right now in the United States. And that's what worries me, because I think that climate of fear is capable of triggering in otherwise decent people actions that are heinous and awful.
And does that include acts of terror and planting out bombs at suicide bombers? And are people, does torture help extract the truth? Does torture ever work, extracting the truth from people who have done these things?
A bundle of questions there. No, I mean, I don't. I don't think torture does. But I mean, you're very right to focus on a different type of violence and heinous act. The violence and the heinous act of the minority group that feels itself subject to some form of oppression, that it then creates arguments for itself to be able to do absolutely monstrous things. And I think that is different. I think, I mean, it's a very interesting question. I'm just thinking about it aloud, actually. When monstrous acts are done by a tiny minority to achieve a political purpose, or when monstrous things are done in the name of the majority against a minority, are those morally distinguishable in some way? I'm asking the question because I haven't thought that through, actually, and I would want to think about it more, but I think it's a very pertinent question to which I don't have an immediate answer. The only thing I would say with certainty is that whether you are in the minority or the majority, in my view, nothing justifies the kinds of acts that we're coming to see in our times in a very live and real way, whether it is the killing of an individual like Charlie Kirk, whose views I would not accord with, but nevertheless, I'm appalled by what has happened, or the events of October the 7th in southern Israel, which were shocking for me because they reminded me of the pogroms of which Lemkin wrote, or the events in Gaza today. So I have trouble, to be honest, understanding how any of these acts trickle up from idea into implementation. But they do, and I fear we're on the cusp of a violent and very difficult time.
So, good violence, Frank was assassination attempt on a train, unsuccessful, but the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich, who had a comparable position to Frank in the Bohemian Morave that was Czechoslovakia hitherto. You can make good violence, can be good, can be good against evil people. Yes.
Well, it's a big question. I'm going to be very careful how I answer that, because it's the kind of answer that one's prone to get into difficulties. One can understand the motivations of the Czechoslovak army folks who killed Heydrich. They justified their actions as being in a time of war, that their country had been occupied, they were freedom fighters for their own country. Is that morally distinguishable? I mean, I spend a lot of time in France, and I spend a lot of time in a small village which was in a resistance area. We have a little house in a village called Bonnieu, which actually is next door to the village called Roussillon, where Samuel Beckett was in the resistance. And it's very hard, as you hear the stories from that era and you meet the descendants of those who were in the resistance, not to salute what they did. And I think that does take one into a different space. When your country is occupied by outsiders, even if, in a sense, the time of war has come to an end and France has, basically given up and cut a deal with the Germans, there are going to be people in France motivated by Charles de Gaulle in, refuge in London, egging them on to oppose the occupation. Can I put my hand on my heart and say I don't salute that type of work? No, I don't. I don't think I can fail to do that. I admire what Samuel Beckett did in the small village of Roussillon as a resistor. But I think that's a very different thing from some of the acts of terror that have taken place. I was in New York on September the 11th. I was teaching at New York University. I've seen the consequences of that terrible action very directly. There is no conceivable justification for such a thing under any circumstances. And I think that is wholly distinguishable from the situation of the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich. But These are complex questions that a lot of people would answer in different ways. And I think one of the things right now that's terribly important is to be able to talk about them in courteous and relatively respectful ways. And I worry that the space for decent conversation and debate is sharply diminishing.
Let's conclude with, you were talking before we started about it's important to give young people a sense of hope. And Steven Pinker, who's just got a new book out, believes that overall human beings are becoming less violent. What are the grounds for optimism, Philippe, that you see? I mean, personally, I've just walked across Europe to Auschwitz in search not of more reprehensible, depraved people, but good women and good men on my walk across Europe. What is it that makes you optimistic as you look ahead over the next decade and beyond?
I think we're living in very difficult times. What are the kinds of things that I take refuge in? I mean, we don't have time to get into them, but I've written two later books, and both are of the kind that give me some degree of hope. One of them is The Last Colony about Chagos. That matter, and I know in the eyes of some, they don't like what has happened, but I give really big credit to successive British governments, including, I don't know whether you've yet written about her, or I can't recall whether you have or will, the great Liz Truss's tenure as Prime Minister. It's not widely known, but one of the things she did on, I think, day two or day three of her 49-day reign, was to reach out to the Mauritians and say, let's sort this Chagos matter. And it has now been sorted. A treaty has been signed, and a decent outcome has been reached, in which the military base continues unhindered, the Chagossians get to go back, Mauritian sovereignty is, you know, respected, and hopefully a fine marine-protected area is created. So that's the kind of thing that makes me think there is hope. And then that extraordinary moment in November 1998, when the House of Lords ruled that Augusto Pinochet did not have immunity for some of the crimes that he had committed during his tenure, I will never forget. I was in the chamber of the House of Lords then, I was involved in the case, and that intake of breath when Lord Hoffman, the fifth judge, said no immunity, I will never forget that. It was a moment of extraordinary hope.
I want you just to say a bit more about that. The two books referred to there are The Last Colony, published in 2022, about Chagos, and 38 Londres Street on Pinochet in London and a Nazi in Patagonia is the title, which came out earlier this year. And so just concluding there on the grounds from hope in that last volume.
Well, Pinochet is arrested.
Just can you explain a bit for those younger people who won't be aware of Pinochet?
Yes, of course. Augusto Pinochet, a military head of the army in Chile, September the 11th, 1973, leads a coup d'etat which deposes a democratically elected but troubled president from the left, Salvador Allende, who dies that day. And Pinochet takes over, runs Chile for 17 years, in the course of which tens of thousands of people are detained and tortured, thousands are killed, and thousands are disappeared. To this day, 1,300 people have still not been accounted for. In 1998, 8 years after he leaves office, he comes to London for medical treatment, maybe to buy arms, to have tea with his friend Lady Thatcher, who he has helped during the Falklands-Malvinas War by giving an airstrip near Patagonia in southern, in Punta Arenas, to the UK to help dislodge the Argentines from the Falklands. And on the evening of the 16th of October, 1998, pursuant to a request from a Spanish judge arguing that he has committed crimes against humanity and genocide, he is arrested. He argues he has absolute immunity for official conduct whilst he was head of state. The House of Lords says no. Under the rules of international law, his immunity as a former head of state is stripped away. And the moment that I was referring to earlier is the moment that the House of Lords first ruled no immunity. There was this extraordinary atmosphere in the chamber. I think Margaret Thatcher was there, actually. I've been in the chamber once when I saw Margaret Thatcher watching some debate, and I think that was the moment, but I can't be 100% sure. And it was as though the world had turned on its axis and basically said to leaders, you are not above the law. You are not powerful forever. Yes, while you're head of state, you have a personal immunity. But once you're out of office, you're subject to the rules like anyone else if you cross a line into international criminality. And that gives me hope. And I suppose the final thing I would say, and right now, this I come back to a lot, it's these two characters, Lauterpacht and Lemkin. I imagine them in 1945. The world is in a shocking state. They fear, but do not yet know, that their entire family, 70, 80 people, have perished in the Holocaust. And they are involved in this trial. And they could have gone and crawled into a corner and wept. But they didn't. They said, no. We have ideas to make the world a better, more decent place. They're limited ideas, but we're going to run with them and try to persuade the world to take them on. And they did. And of course, they were hopeful and excessively hopeful in the force of their ideas and the consequence of their ideas. But nevertheless, they sort of embodied that part of the human spirit which says, even in the most adverse of times and conditions, we don't lie down and weep. We just battle on. We stick to our principles and our values until a better day comes.
There can't be a better note and better words to complete this wonderful, remarkable podcast on Philippe than those. So let's keep those words hanging eternally in the air. And thank you very much indeed for everything that you've said.
Thank you for inviting me, Anthony. A real pleasure.